Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. A little reminder, we are Zooming on Tuesday afternoon, so if something should happen Tuesday night, we may be talking about it on Thursday. Anyway, before we begin our show, you've come to expect this now. As Calvin Trillin is to The Nation magazine, my friend ST is to The Attitude. So we begin with a little political verse. From the Donald, there'll be no concession. He's unwielding like a sword-wielding Hessian. He believes his lies and his false battle cries. If he were Catholic, he'd spend months in confession. Welcome back, everyone. So we have a fabulous guest from the Washington Monthly who I have interviewed a couple of times, and I'm so glad to grab him back. But I warned Daniel Block from the Washington Monthly that I have to begin with a poem because today is Veterans Day. We're taping on Tuesday, but the show will air on Veterans Day. And I'm gonna dedicate this poem to my father, who was a veteran, to my husband, who was a veteran, and to my two uncles who died in World War II. So there's a lot of contribution and loss in my family. But the title of the poem is entitled Lonely Eagles. It's by a very famous poet, Marilyn Nelson. But what makes Marilyn even more special is that her father was a Tuskegee Airman. And so this comes from knowledge of him and his relationships with the other Tuskegee Airmen. And just to let you know that they were the first Black military aviators in the U.S. Army Air Corps. That was what existed before the U.S. Air Force. And they flew more than 15,000 individual sorties in Europe and North Africa. So this is Marilyn Nelson's poem entitled Lonely Eagles. For Daniel Chappie James, General USAF, and for the 332nd Fighter Group. Being Black in America was the original catch. So no one was surprised by 22. The segregated airstrips separate camps. They did the jobs they'd been trained to do. Black ground crews kept them in the air. Black flight surgeons kept them alive. The whole group removed their headgear when another pilot died. They were known by their names, Ace and Lucky, Skyhawk Johnny, Mr. Death, and by their positions and planes, Red Leader to Yellow Wingman, do you copy? If you could find a fresh egg, you bought it and hid it in your dope box or your boot until you could eat it alone. On the night before a mission, you gave a buddy your hiding places as solemnly as a man dictating his will. There's a chocolate bar in my Bible. My whiskey bottle is inside my bedroll. In beat up Flying Tigers that had seen action in Burma, they shot down three German jets. They were the only outfit in the American Air Corps to sink a destroyer with fighter planes. Fighter planes with names like By Request. Sometimes the radios didn't even work. They called themselves Hell from Heaven, the Spookwaffe. My father's old friends. It was always maximum effort, a whole squadron of brother men raced across the tarmac and mounted their planes. My tent mate was a guy named Starks. The funny thing about me and Starks was that my air mattress leaked and Starks didn't. Every time he went up, I gave my mattress to Starks and put his on my cot. One day we were strafing a train. Strafing's bad news. You have to fly so low and slow, you're a pretty clear target. My other wingmen and I exhausted our ammunition and got out. I recognized Starks by his red tail and his rudder's trim tabs. He couldn't pull up his nose. He dived into the train and bought the farm. I found his chocolate, three eggs, and a full fifth of his hoarded up whiskey. And I used his mattress for the rest of my tour. It still bothers me sometimes. I was sleeping on his breath. Lonely Eagles, an amazing poem, makes me cry. I read it every Veterans Day. And the most fabulous poet on the planet is Marilyn Nelson. Follow her, read her. She has incredible stories to tell. Daniel Block, it has been a long time. He is the executive editor of the Washington Monthly. Before joining the Monthly, Daniel was a 2017-2018 Loos Scholar living in Delhi, India, where he studied Hindi and worked for The Caravan, a leading Indian politics and policy magazine. Daniel's writing has also appeared in Foreign Policy, The Philadelphia Inquirer, The American Prospect, and we are so lucky that we get to grab him every once in a while. His piece was important. We may have dodged a bullet, but it's only because the man that we were fighting was not only someone who had authoritarian tendencies, but he wasn't really, really that good at politics, as good as he claims to be. The next authoritarian might be much better and much more clever. So just realize we dodged a bullet. The title of his piece, Nationalism is Ascendant Around the Globe. Biden just defeated its biggest leader. Welcome to the program, Daniel. It's a pleasure to have you back. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thanks for having me back, and thanks for that beautiful reading at the beginning.
Oh, it's incredible. So because you have spent so much time in India, so much of what you write really is, I think, impacted by that experience. So you're always, I think, interesting from my perspective. Whenever I call you, you're comparing and contrasting. And that I love that because, again, we need to understand, we're so xenophobic in this country. We don't know what's happening around the world. I mean, I wish we had the BBC. I mean, we do, but we don't like use it as our sort of regular news source. And you begin by talking about calling a friend in India. So I want you to share the Indian experience with what we just quote unquote dodged in air quotes, because what was so frightening was how similar it felt, the story that you write about Modi. And I want people to hear this story, hear about him, and understand the idea of vigilance. You know, we know that Biden won. It's going to be difficult for him to actually ascend to power because of Donald Trump, but he will eventually get there. The question is, can we deal with the 70 million that still see Donald Trump as the anointed? And for whatever reason, that cult of personality also has the ability to do something very frightening. And that's called vote.
So yeah, I'll start with the experience of liberals in India, because I think, like you said, it's really important as we think about what happened here to understand what happened there. So in 2014, Narendra Modi, who's a hard right Hindu nationalist candidate, won the prime ministership in the country. And he won a pretty commanding victory in 2014, really a landslide. And people were expecting that. That win wasn't surprising. And there was a lot of concern about what would happen next, particularly within India. This is a man who had a track record while he was leading one of India's states of engaging in some pretty horrible behavior. Most famously, there was a lot of violence against Muslims, massacre effectively that happened while he was in charge, where could be up to 2,000 people. Most of the Muslims died at the hand of largely Hindu rioters and the police. And Modi, at a minimum, did nothing to really stop that from happening. There is evidence that members of his party actually aided and abetted in the carrying out of that violence. So this is a man with quite a record and who comes from a political party that has deep ties to this kind of ideology and frankly, this kind of violence. And he wins and his first 5 years go about as you'd expect. And then he's running for re-election in 2019. And I think,
what does that mean, the first 5 years went as you would expect? Does he continue to target Muslims? What does he do? Does he fix the economy? Does he deal with inequality? Does he help different parts of the country to actually improve? What are the 5 years? We know the 4 years of Donald Trump was basically aiding and abetting the wealthy, you know, basically targeting everyone who was his enemy, dismantling government, and either replacing it with his lackeys or basically leaving it vacant, which is exactly what he wanted, and sort of said to corporate America, you know, here's your license to do whatever you want. So that's the 4 years of Trump. What were the first couple of years of Modi, and what did people expect, and what did he deliver?
So the first 5 years of Modi have a lot in common with Trump's term in office. You have an uptick in incidents of violence against Muslims in the country. You have certainly a far more aggressive, nasty, and exclusionary uptick in rhetoric by the central Indian government that accompanies these incidents of violence that are happening along the ground. You have one state, India's largest state in particular, which comes to be governed by somebody who belongs to Modi's same party. The police there engage in really an epidemic of extrajudicial killings against Muslims in particular. And to be clear, there's also violence targeted at Dalits, people who are low on that caste spectrum in India, as well as other different minorities. At the same time, part of why Modi was able to win in 2014 is he campaigned as an economic reformer. He said, India is bloated, the bureaucracy is dysfunctional. There are all these kind of rules and regulations, and I'll bring better days. So he comes to office, this kind of standard conservative economic pitch. By all accounts, he does not deliver. He engages in a lot of policy making. He tries to standardize certain tax codes that are meant to signal, largely, I think, a part of the international business community that India is, quote, open for business. Again, air quotes around that. But by the time he's running for re-election in 2019, the economy is arguably, sorry, he won in 2014, so 2019, 5 years. And the economy is arguably in worse shape than it was when he first took office. India has a large youth population. They are not finding jobs, a lot of them. GDP growth is slowing down. So it's really quite grim. And that's why when he ran for re-election, I think a lot of people expected that he would lose seats. Polling indicated that he would lose seats, that he would still probably come out as prime minister, but that he might have to go into coalition with different parties in order to stay in his position. That's not what happens. He wins overwhelmingly. He wins bigger than he did the last time before. He picks up 21 seats. And I want to emphasize, his campaign was so heavily tied to nationalism and exclusionary rhetoric. I mean, it's really centered around referring to different immigrants, almost all Muslims, as invaders, intruders, people who need to be uprooted. There's a scuffle at the border between India and Pakistan. Pakistan, obviously, is a majority Muslim country. The two used to be one country during the days of the British Raj. They were partitioned during independence and have a long history of conflict. Modi really raises a lot of nationalist furor around that, and he rides a lot of that to victory.
So I have to ask a question. Yeah. Does Modi have a Fox? A Fox News? Another? I know absolutely serious here, because we had a reporter on the other day and we talked about what sort of helped to precipitate Trump. And it was like talk radio and social media and Fox News, you know, his echo chamber. But the other thing he also said was the loss of sort of local news, that you really weren't getting the reporting from the states and from the streets and from the counties and from the cities. And you saw the sort of loss at the sort of local level. And then you saw, obviously, what happened with, you know, Fox, which is the most watched cable station in the country, 24/7 Rush Limbaugh, the social media. What explains what you saw happening in India over the 5 years with Modi from 2014 to 2019, that everyone sort of thought, oh my God, look what's happening to our country. Of course they won't, you know, give him more seats. Of course he's going to have to find some kind of a coalition government. But as you point out in your piece, 2019 was an overwhelming embrace of Modi. And that's shocking, given all the inputs you just described. I'm just trying to figure out, how did those inputs not equal you're gone, or at least you're controlled? And how did those inputs get either muzzled or distorted so that the electorate saw Modi as a solution still, despite what happened over 5 freaking years?
The question of media in India is extremely interesting. And the answer is Modi does not have one fox. Modi has many foxes. And I mean that both in that you have TV stations where if you were to turn them on, you would recognize them as fox-like, in that you have conservative commentators and anchors angrily kind of yelling, playing very fast and loose with the truth, to be charitable in its categorization. Perhaps the most famous one of these is a man named Arnab Goswami, who hosted a primetime show for a while. He's actually recently arrested right around the time that the election went on, not for reasons related to his politics. So you have some of that, but that's actually only kind of a fraction of it. The bigger media problem in India is that there is not the same kind of robust independent press you have in many other parts of the world, including the United States. So most of the major publishing houses in the country, many of the major broadcast channels, especially those that are operating in English, they feel beholden to various degrees to the governing party. There's various reasons for that. First, the party, you know, exercises quite a bit of judicial threats, but there's a financial incentive too, where a lot of advertising that props up various different media houses comes from government contracts directly or from major companies that are closely aligned with the government. So they have quite a bit of financial weight they can.
So wait, you're telling me that the government government buys advertising on these stations?
Correct.
Wow. Okay. That kind of influence is really frightening. I mean, what I keep going back to is Donald Trump in 2015 and 2016, who was a ratings god and got billions of dollars of free media because he was able to produce revenue. But what you're telling me is that the government can actually use contracts with the media, marketing contracts, to basically, you know, keep certain stations afloat. And obviously, depending on who's in charge, guess where the contracts go?
They go to stations that prevent favorable coverage. So it's very much a weaponization of what in a functioning democratic society would be neutral. The government in the United States spends money to advertise this, but it's not used right now. Trump, I'm sure, tried to or wanted to do this, or I guess hadn't thought about it, but it's not used to pick winners and losers in the market to nearly the same extent as it is in India. And it's also these major companies that are closely aligned with the government and that will do what the government asks.
Because Modi was open for business.
Yes.
Not necessarily India, but Modi was definitely open for business.
Modi was certainly, the entire apparatus.
In your article, you write, nationalism is ascendant around the globe. And I just want to just pull up a couple of sentences out of your piece, because the beginning begins with Modi and the parallels are frightening everyone. You then write, in addition to Modi's two wins in 2018, Bolsonaro won a commanding presidential victory in Brazil. In Poland, right-wing nationalists have been ascendant for roughly 5 years, and Orban has governed Hungary for more than 10. Benjamin Netanyahu, I'm so glad you included him, has been prime minister of Israel for over a decade, despite many close calls. The United Kingdom voted to leave the European Union in 2015. In many of these races, including the Brexit referendum, nationalists stunned observers by overperforming polls and expectations. It happened here in 2016. So what I'm just trying to figure out is, what's the feeder here? I began to get nervous when we referred to the United States as, we didn't call her the motherland, the homeland. We started using a term about the United States, referring to it as the homeland, about maybe 4 or 5 years ago. And I heard that term and I'm like, why does this feel like Germany? That was an expression I had never heard us use in relationship to the United States. And Democrats and Republicans both used it, which I thought was just shocking. But every time I hear the term homeland, I start to twitch. Because to me, it is, again, it's a subtle reinforcement of this nationalism that you talk about. And what I'm trying to figure out is there an antidote to nationalism? And what do you think is the sort of the fertilizer that makes it so potent and so able to overcome so much failure and yet still embrace a win in an authoritarian figure?
Both are obviously, I think, the key questions of our time. I wish I had clear answers. I suppose I've got a better sense when it comes to the fertilizer. It's strong in the United States. It's strong in India. It's strong in Israel. It's strong around the world in a whole host of different countries. And it's, in a sense, it's majoritarian resentment. It's a sense by groups that have majorities, the ethnic majority in the countries, white Christians in the United States, Hindus in India, actually Hindu nationalists, high caste Hindus are not a majority, and different Jewish groups in Israel, that they feel or are concerned that their right to an ethnic nation is under siege or under threat. And so when you have candidates who are very adroit at channeling that sense of resentment, at creating an imagined sense of resentment, at making them feel as if they are under attack in some way, which they're not, you're able to polarize the electorate along ethnic lines. And if you polarize an electorate along ethnic lines, and you are the party that harnesses the energy of the ethnic majority, you are able to win a whole lot of votes. And that's what's frightening.
You write this just as Biden looks like he won, and I believe he did. And I think he will win by more than 7 million votes, popular votes. But you know, the popular vote has no meaning. Unfortunately, it's all about the Electoral College, but he'll probably have over 300 votes in the Electoral College. It will not be an easy ascendant. You heard me read my first political limerick, which is about the fact that Donald Trump will not concede. He probably never will. Okay. He will leave office with his, you know, finger in his mouth and whatever, assuming he leaves office and isn't escorted out. I mean, I have this image in my mind of Justice Roberts under one arm and Mitch McConnell under the other. I don't want the military involved. I don't want them involved because that's not the right thing. But I want those two men to walk him out. That's who I see walking him out. But what's so interesting about this is that even though Biden has won, we still are looking at a Senate that has a couple of races still up in the air, especially in Georgia. And what is remarkable to me is that the Republicans are afraid to admit that Donald Trump has lost because they need to somehow hold together this illusion of a potential Trump win in order to bring these two Republicans in Georgia across the finish line. So they are willing to do everything, including ignore the vote, including ignore the facts, including ignore the calls, in order to create this illusion for, you know, two additional Senate races that will occur sometime in early January. So what message do you send to Joe Biden, given the experience in India that you just described, given what we've seen happening around the country? Is there an antidote? We had a speaker on Monday, and he said that what he sees needs to happen for the 70 million is that they need to be, this is the word he used, rehabilitated. That was the word he used. And I keep thinking, when I think of rehabilitation, I think of a drug addict. You know what I mean? And yet that's what he said. And I'm just wondering whether in politics, the concept of rehabilitation is even possible, given that you may pass policies that touch people's lives, but if you're still looking at an echo chamber that is reinforcing things that are not factual, even if you have food on your plate, you think you're being deprived of dessert.
Republicans are very good, I think, at using policies to create politics. Democrats in recent years, I think, have used politics to create policies. And I think in order to deal with this problem, what you need is you need Democrats to be willing to use policies to create politics. They need to be able to pass an agenda or do things that are going to create constituencies and what political scientists would call policy feedback loops that allow them to keep winning elections. That's going to be really, really hard, because unless Democrats win both of those Senate seats in Georgia or something happens in Alaska or you know, North Carolina, which is unlikely, Biden's going to have to do it alone. The Biden administration is kind of going to be on its own. It's going to be facing a hostile Senate in Mitch McConnell. It's going to be facing hostile courts. So it's going to have to figure out what it can do through regulatory decision-making and executive action that will allow it to try and create these feedback loops. One thing that I've talked about before, and Arnie, you and I have discussed this when I've come on in the past, is the need to try and find ways to economically revitalize, in particular, metropolitan areas and rural areas that are not on the coast or other economic hubs of activity right now. I mean, you see Georgia, for example, looks like it's going to give its electoral votes to Biden. That's in no small part because the Atlanta metro region has become so vibrant and diverse, and it's just attracted a ton of people and energy. And so I think trying to look at ways that he can use whatever ladder, you know, kind of whatever maneuvers he has economically to make sure that economic development does not continue to be concentrated in the same few places will do enormous work.
And that's where that infrastructure thing can be targeted. Okay. And infrastructure now can be very elastic. What do we mean by infrastructure? And I think, you know, we know Republicans want infrastructure. We know Democrats want infrastructure. Of course, their definition of infrastructure will not be the same. You and I both know that. So it'll be very interesting to me, because we've seen climate change having a huge impact on places like Iowa, Nebraska, and Oklahoma. And it means that, you know, even in the agricultural field, how do they survive this? And is there things that we can do to sort of supplement income? We know, for example, in Iowa, I go to Iowa a lot, and what I am amazed by is that wind turbines are everywhere. Well, you know, maybe we need to figure out another way of creating additional energy infrastructure in Iowa. So the farmer who may not be getting his soybeans at a certain price is getting more because he's growing wind turbines. You know what I'm saying? And so I think that that's Biden's opportunity. But I was thinking about something, because I know you worked with the Prospect. They did a whole series on the executive orders that Joe Biden could do in the first 10 days, the first day even. And they came out with a whole series of them. What is so terrifying about the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg and the 6-3 court is that Republicans, when it's their executive orders and their president, and not a problem, but now that it's going to be Biden and executive orders or Biden and regulatory policy, they will be taking him to court literally within seconds of an executive order, within seconds of sort of implementing some kind of regulatory authority. And that's going to be what is so harmful to the country, is that even if he wants to produce something, they are going to make sure that they put the brakes on to make it even more difficult. And they have a very conservative, corporate-leaning court that will be, I think, very accommodating.
I think that's right. And that's why it's worth keeping in mind. I mean, I don't know how it was in New Hampshire and DC. People were literally dancing in the streets on Saturday And I'm all for people celebrating the work of organizing and fighting is hard and you have to celebrate wins when they come. But this is not anywhere near the end. This is just the beginning. What can happen in other countries can still happen here. You can have a more talented, competent politician who could do what Trump did. I mean, we'll see to what extent his base is transferable. And given the immense obstacles that Democrats are going to face in the Senate, in the judiciary, it's going to be a long and hard fight to try and tackle this problem. And I remain worried.
Well, I'm worried too, because despite what happened with Joe Biden at the top of the ticket, this is the gerrymandering legislature at the state level. We did not get the capacity to actually increase or to change any of the gerrymandered districts. The Republicans control the map. And what's worse, especially in Texas, which I think is going to be gaining seats, the Republicans maintain control of the legislature in Texas. So it's not even like the numbers are going to be different. The numbers are going to be better for whom? For the GOP. So it gets harder and harder. And then the question is, how do you sprint and change? And who knows? It's going to be we're at the very, very beginning of a huge slog. Daniel Block, you must come back. I always learned so much from you. Thank you so much for writing for the Washington Monthly. The title of his piece, Nationalism is Ascendant Around the Globe. Biden just defeated its biggest leader. He underperformed polls, but compared to what's happened in other countries, the Democrats' victory is a remarkable achievement. Join us again. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Stick around, everyone. This is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. We'll be right back.
What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? I learned that Washington never told a lie. I learned that soldiers seldom die. I learned that everybody's free. And that's what the teacher said to me. And that's what I learned in school today. That's what I learned in school. And what did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? I learned that policemen are my friends. I learned that justice never ends. I learned that murderers die for the crimes, even if we make a mistake sometimes. And that's what I learned in school today. That's what I learned in school. And what did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? I learned our government must be strong. It's always right and never wrong. Our leaders are the finest men, and we elect them again and again. And that's what I learned in school today. That's what I learned in school.
Welcome back to part two of the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. So someone flagged me about a book, and it's a book about Betsy DeVos and the powerful conservative network fighting to destroy public education. And I went, the title, A Wolf at the Schoolhouse Door, The Dismantling of Public Education and the Future of School. Joining me right now are the two authors, Jack Schneider and Jennifer Berkshire. So Jack, tell my audience a little bit about your sort of portfolio, and then I'm going to ask you to do the same thing, Jennifer, because I want people to understand that you come to this book because it's almost your life story as you were able to put this together. And the fact that the two of you sort of work together, but at the same time have been watching what has been going on. This is not a new story. The story of the dismantling of public education has been actually going on for decades. And I will share a story with you going back to 1971. So I'm going to start actually with you, Jack Schneider.
Sure. Well, thanks for having us. My story in education begins back when I was a high school history teacher many years ago, and then went to graduate school and eventually became a professor of education. And as so often happens, I teach at UMass Lowell, by the way, and as so often happens, as we move away from the classroom, we become increasingly irrelevant. So we are writing behind paywalls in peer-reviewed journals that nobody reads. And so I began working to get outside of the ivory tower a bit, writing in popular publications. And then one day, Jennifer rang my metaphorical doorbell and asked if I would co-host a podcast with her. And the promise was that we would only do it for a short period of time, and it might be something like a trial run. And we just recorded our 100th episode. Well, along the way, I learned a tremendous amount, and I think the two things that led to this book were, first, that Jennifer and I both thrive, and I won't speak for her, but I particularly thrive on the feeling that we're reaching people. We're reaching teachers, we're reaching activists, we're reaching people who send their kids to public schools and who want to know more, who want to know how to advocate on behalf of their own kids and on behalf of other kids. And the other piece was, I think every time we record an episode, we both learn something. We learn from each other, we learn from our guests. And along the way, we realize that we actually had something to offer in the form of a book to the public, to those interested in the preservation of public education, and that it really tied together everything that we had learned from our podcast over the years. And that really, I think, taught us something really powerful about the present threat to public education. Somebody asked us, are you trying to scare people with this book? And I think originally the answer was no. And by the time we were done, the answer was absolutely.
Well, it's interesting. I totally understand your experience with your podcast. I've been doing talk radio since 1988. I've gotten 12 PhDs since 1988. And that has come from people like our first guest, Daniel Block, who teaches me so much every time, and you will continue to teach me. And the value of that is not just what it's done for me. And I just want to share a really quick story, Jennifer. I replaced Rush Limbaugh, believe it or not, on five stations for a couple of years. And it was in the central part of New Hampshire, which is sort of an interesting, quirky place between the very liberal part of the state and the very conservative part of the state. And I used to say occasionally on the radio, I would say, oh, I'm so pissed off. Well, I got a phone call one day and it was from the sheriff's office, okay? And I'm like, ugh. And I pick it up and it was one of the sheriffs and he said, Arnie, we just need to let you know that you can't use the term pissed off. And I said, why not? He said, because we go to school with Arnie Arneson from 12 to 3 every day and our teacher doesn't say pissed off. So that is why you do the podcast. That is why you speak out in what you think is the ether, because you don't know who's going to hear you. You don't know how they're going to process. And then they take that story and they share it at a coffee clutch or they do whatever. So I'm so grateful you're at 100. And I really do hope that you continue to go to 200 and 300 because there, unfortunately, there'll be too much material and we need to figure out how to be connected with facts. So Jennifer, a little bit about Jennifer Berkshire.
I will admit that I am kind of obsessed with education. In fact, my husband had to institute a rule in our house that there's to be no edu chatter before 8 a.m. And one of my great frustrations is that the education stories get relegated to their own sort of subbeat, and people really don't see how this is the central issue playing out in the states. And I would absolutely include a state like yours. And after Betsy DeVos was nominated, I headed straight to Michigan. I knew that name. I grew up in the Midwest. I knew that family name. And what I found there as I traveled around was that, yes, you know, she was all about expanding charter schools, but really, their focus was on undercutting the teachers' unions as a way to weaken the Democratic Party. And so you could see the same agenda playing out in state after state. And I think the more Jack and I talked about this stuff and interviewed other people, and I continued to travel, and I noticed so in so many places what you were describing, Arnie, which is that there will be sort of a little Betsy DeVos ensconced at the state level, but they all use the exact same language and they're rolling out the identical policy playbook. So we wrote this book in an effort to shed light on where that playbook comes from, what it's going to look like when it gets to a state like yours, and hopefully how you can start to poke some holes in it.
You know, it's interesting. I'm the daughter of two school teachers. No surprise. And my father was a teacher of the year in New York City. My father was an amazing, gifted, talented man. And he decided in 1971, when I went to St. Olaf College in Northfield, Minnesota, yeah, sure, you betcha. I'd never been to the Midwest. My father is going to fly me out there. And we're on the airplane and we're having all these father-daughter conversations. And I adored my father. I worshiped him. I thought he was just the best teacher. So my dad said to me, so what are you thinking about doing? Like, what do you really want to be? What are you going to pursue? And I kind of said something a little bit about education. Now remember, this is 1971. And he said, whatever you do, don't become a teacher. Oh my God. Oh my God. This is the man I adored. This is a guy who taught Nobel Prize winners. This is, and that's because he already began to feel that there was an assault on public education, that the respect of the school teacher had begun to disappear, that the investment, that the knowledge, that education was being given so many tasks to accomplish for society because society wasn't feeding people, because they weren't clothing people, because they were, and it was like he couldn't even get into education because he had to make sure they had pencils to go home with. And this was 1971. So as I see you reading this book and you want to frighten people, I'm going to beg you to frighten people, because this is not just about education. And I think you know this, Jack, this is about democracy. Democracy doesn't function in a vacuum. It doesn't function in ignorance. It doesn't function without teaching civics. And yet not only is Betsy DeVos and my version of Betsy DeVos in New Hampshire is, a you know, like Frank Edelblut is Betsy DeVos in pants. I mean, identical. Everything about their background is identical. If I had described Frank Edelblut to you, you would have assumed I was talking about Betsy DeVos because of their lack of any kind of knowledge of public education and their whole agenda, and they're being very rich and everyone's homeschooled, and it's just disgusting. But Jack, that's where I think public education has to be almost at the top of every conversation, because if you care about democracy and you care about exercising the franchise, if you don't connect it to education, then you have failed democracy and you will never achieve the success you're looking at, which is an engaged citizenry.
And that's exactly what those who are intent on dismantling public education know. They know that public education creates a new kind of citizen who is more empowered to participate in a representative democracy, who is going to have higher expectations for their lives, for what they can earn, for what they deserve. They are going to envision themselves as different people by the end of the K-12 process, and many of them will go on to higher education to get a two-year degree or a four-year degree. And they will envision themselves as equal participants in a society that is in many ways non-hierarchical. Well, that doesn't serve the advantage of the interests of the privileged, right? That doesn't serve the interests of those who already have more and who aren't particularly interested in funding public education through their tax dollars, which they believe belong to them. They believe that those dollars should stay in their bank accounts rather than going to fund things like public schools for young people who aren't their children. And it's worth noting here that public education is number one on the agenda for many of these far-right conservatives because it's a $500 billion annual expenditure. We don't talk about it that way because so much of it is funded through local property taxes. So much is funded through particular kinds of state taxes. Lotteries are a popular way. Only a small amount is funded by the federal government, about 9% on average. But collectively, it is a massive expenditure in the United States, and it is the biggest commitment that we make to Americans. And I say Americans, not American citizens, because we make it to all young people, yes, regardless of their paperwork, right? We make a commitment to them. And there are people who just simply don't believe in that.
So Jennifer, what I'm kind of curious about, let's take a little bit, I know you've written your book, but obviously we're living in a very interesting time. And I don't know whether by the time you finish your book, you are aware that we are going to be living with a pandemic, but we are. And we're living with a pandemic with Betsy DeVos as the head of education nationally. And Betsy DeVos, because there's money attached to responding to the pandemic, some of that money flowed through her. So let's talk about Betsy DeVos, education and a pandemic, because we're all terrified. We're all suddenly realizing how important schools are. And they're not just important because they feed children, because they educate children, but because they're a daycare and they're important for work and they're important for people to actually conduct business. But Betsy DeVos also knows that this is a really good opportunity for her to do a lot of dismantling in a very short period of time, because the thing she hates, public education, is more vulnerable now than it has ever been before.
You are absolutely correct with that. And she saw an immediate opportunity. In fact, we open our book with her seeing an opportunity. She's asked, "Do you see the pandemic as an opportunity to expand private school choice?" And her answer is absolutely. So she sees this, you know, there's all this money. And so she immediately sets about figuring out how to incentivize states to use this money to expand vouchers, right? This is her main priority. authority. And right away, you see her and her allies, including these, you know, fairly prominent think tanks like Heritage that are steering the conversation about the pandemic response, saying this is really the time to make a push to have the money follow the child, right? That wherever the child goes is where the money will go. And obviously, if you think about this for, you know, 30 seconds, you realize that that means that schools that are closed right now will effectively never reopen, right? And so if that's your goal, you could see why the pandemic would be this big opportunity. So those are a couple of the things that she's done. And I think like it's what she hasn't done that's been the worst here. And that's that she's played no leadership role whatsoever as far as helping schools figure out how to reopen. If New Hampshire is anything like Massachusetts, our local districts are really, you know, sort of flailing, right? It's an enormously difficult task and they're having to navigate it all on their own. And so she's basically made a point of saying that they're not going to do anything like track outbreaks at schools, right? Or share best practices, right? And so getting in the way of helping schools respond. So that's a terrible thing. And then I think to me, the great irony of this is that the ultimate vision of a Betsy DeVos is what we're looking at right now, which is that if you're a family of means, you can go to a private school, right? And maybe your school is open now. But if you're not a family of means, you're getting this kind of lesser virtual education. And so you'll notice that a lot of the people who really believe in this vision, they are not so critical of virtual education. Like your Frank Edelblut thinks it's just great, right? That even as everyone else is saying, what a disaster. Like he talks about it in these glowing terms that, wow, you have children who are directing their own education. What an opportunity. And so I think you see Betsy DeVos and her lieutenants all over the country really seizing on this opportunity. And as a result, parents and kids are left to deal with this on their own.
Well, I'm confused though, because I heard Frank and I hear Betsy, but then I hear that you must open schools. So here, you see, you've got like this split message. I mean, I feel like I'm going to go crazy. Oh, you know, virtual is great. Oh, but you must open schools. Virtual is great, except if you live in rural New Hampshire, where there is no ability to actually access the internet, where there may only be one computer in a house. How do you Zoom with four kids when there's only one computer and the internet access sucks? And there's I have to get this reporter on from VT Digger, but I read a story about Vermont, and Vermont is doing something really interesting because they began to realize how many students were not participating virtually. You know, they may have a class of, you know, 22, but there was only 14 that were actually participating in Zoom. And so what they are suddenly realizing they need to do is they need to go to those homes to find out what's happening, how to help. Well, that's wonderful. I love the idea. They're not going as a threat. They're going as a help, you know, like the social worker on a horse who's coming in. But that is monetarily so expensive. When they get there, what are they delivering? Are they delivering a computer? Are they delivering better internet access? Are they delivering a parent at home that can help them? I mean, I feel like no matter which way you turn, Jack, this pandemic is so harmful for public education because you're vulnerable either way. When you open schools, you're vulnerable. When you're home, you're vulnerable. And yet what private schools have is something public schools don't have, which is they can monetize everything. They can build a moat around their school. They can pay for every kind of test known to man. And they can do something that creates this sort of island of education when by definition, public schools can't be an island, Jack.
Well, the seemingly schizophrenic response from federal leaders like DeVos or people at the state level, particularly in red states, but also in purple states like New Hampshire. New Hampshire's red and blue all over, is really consistent, actually, because the consistent message is, let's create chaos. They, of course, would not necessarily say that out loud, but that's the consistency, right? So people called out Betsy DeVos at the federal level for being ideologically inconsistent. She had spent her entire life saying the federal government has no business telling schools what to do. And what does she do in the midst of a pandemic? She says all states must require all schools to test children in grades 3 through 8 in 1 year of high school. Standardized tests must be given. Now, here's somebody who has shown no interest in standardized test scores. When people have pushed back and said, wait a minute, some of these virtual schools are like the lowest performers by a lot. Some studies have found that students learned the equivalent of 0 days of school in some of these virtual schools, according to standardized tests. Now, standardized tests, you know, they don't measure a whole lot, but they measure something. And she's dismissed those. She has said, well, actually, that's not the right way to measure school quality. Let's just let parents vote with their feet or with their dollars. So what does it mean then when somebody like Betsy DeVos, who has totally dismissed standardized test scores, which again, should absolutely be taken with a grain of salt, which often tell us more about demography than they do about school quality. What should we make sense of here? It's that she just wants to make the work of public school teachers and public school administrators more difficult. She wants to make public schools look terrible. And they do when they have to come out and say, in the midst of a pandemic, when you're trying to keep your family safe, when you are trying to make sure that your kid has internet access, or that when your kid's coming to school, if the school is open, that your kid is safe, that your family is able to make do, that standardized testing is going to be a priority. It makes schools look completely out of touch, and she gets that. And like so many of these attacks on public education, which really are a state level issue, so people in New Hampshire really need to tune in, despite the fact that DeVos will be on the way out, that much of the effort is really about disrupting public education to create a window of opportunity to create a system that is privatized, that advances a religious agenda, breaks teachers' unions, and that reduces expenditures on public education, particularly for the least advantaged.
So you said you're not allowed to talk about education before 8 o'clock. Well, thank God you don't live with me. But anyway, because I'm very passionate about this. But I'm also going back to my father, because this is how I sort of learned. And when I was a child, my father would not read me the Red Fairy Tale book and the Green Fairy Tale book. He'd read me the Christian Science Monitor and the Wall Street Journal. That was what he read to me at night. But that's because he would insist that his students read papers all the time. They would get a current events test every single week. I don't know about schools that have kids reading papers. I don't know about schools that do current events tests. In fact, I know that civics now, the teaching of civics, is a political agenda. So teachers are even afraid to bring it up. So what is so interesting to me is that I look at all these sort of yah-yah private schools, St. Paul's, Phillips Exeter, and they celebrate politics and they celebrate news, and none of them get tested. None of them have the first grade, second grade, whatever those tests. They don't spend any time, so they don't have to teach for the test, but they teach for knowledge. And what I think is so interesting from what Jack said, Jennifer, is that the conservatives use testing any way they want, not only to cause chaos, but they want to use it when it's convenient to prove failure, not success, to prove failure.
Yeah, and the reason we know this is because if you actually look at the policy options that they are they're pushing with, you know, great fanfare at the state level, it's to expand private school choice with no oversight at all, right? And so not only would you not take a test, but there would be no way for the public to have any insight as to where that money went. So the model, and New Hampshire is, you know, there have been several attempts in New Hampshire to implement a similar model. It's really, if you look at what's happened in Arizona, what they've done is they've come up with a program that uses what they call edu debit cards, where they preload a portion of the state per pupil spending onto a debit card, and the parent basically can spend it on whatever they want.
How convenient. It's like going to Target, only it's public education.
Exactly. And school, even the concept of school is seen as too limiting, right? That what they want is, you know, a whole, like a vast terrain of learning options, and all of which are basically for profit, but it's up to the parent to decide, to make that decision. Do they want to spend it on tutoring? Do they want to spend it on individual classes? Do they want to buy an online program or a homeschooling curriculum? Do they want to team up with other parents who are also homeschoolers and use their EduDebit cards that way?
Well, you know, it's I'm so frightened, and I'm ecstatic that you wrote your book. A Wolf at the Schoolhouse Door: The Dismantling of Public Education and the Future of School. But as I'm hearing all this, I'm also frustrated with education, and I understand that I don't want charter schools. I kind of want charter education. And what do I mean by that? Is that the model needs to change because society has changed. I always say that we have more in common with schools in raising corn than raising kids. It's still operating on an agricultural kind of calendar. It's still assuming that maybe there's a mother at home at 2:30. It's making all these assumptions that don't make sense. It also assumes that you should start at kindergarten or first grade when you probably should be starting at second, 2 years old or 3 years old, that it needs to start sooner. It needs to extend longer. It needs to be so versatile. So my problem is that not only do we set it up to fail and create chaos, but we don't liberate it to be better. We don't allow it to experiment, not for failure, but for success. And that's the other problem, is that people keep saying they get so rigid because they want to protect their public schools. But I don't want to do a snapshot in time. I want them to grow and evolve and be better. But we're so fighting the fact that we're being challenged to even exist. And that's what breaks my heart, Jennifer.
I think you're absolutely right to be concerned about that. And I think that that's, all the more reason. Like, we end our book on what we hope is a hopeful note, that, I spent a lot of time traveling around to rural communities where the love that people have for their schools is intense. I believe that it's something that could potentially bridge that huge gap between urban and rural communities. But you're right. If people feel like they're having to just dig in order to defend the institution, they can't make it what it needs to be. And I feel like coming out of the pandemic, we have an opportunity, whether it's focusing on civics, whether it's recognizing that we're simply asking schools to do too many things that they shouldn't have to do, that it shouldn't be the responsibility of a school district to provide internet access for the town, right? And that if we loosen the reins a little bit, and of course we should be mindful that this is very similar to the argument that a Betsy DeVos often uses, we want to see that creativity flourish, but we also just have to be so careful that we don't end up destroying it in the process. And I know this is something that Jack is so passionate about, and he's probably just bobbing up and down waiting to say something.
But that's it, Jack. I am always thinking outside the box, but the box of public education I believe in. I want to support it and celebrate it. And I also want it to be able to get better. And I'm so angry at those that assault it, because what they're doing is, in some ways, they're living up, they're creating that prophecy that we fail, because they're not giving us the opportunity to succeed.
And I just wanted to ask you folks a question about what I would call more political differences, and that is what the schools teach. Because I know that the Republicans and DeVos people and Trump are constantly criticizing public schools because they're all a bunch of lefties and they're teaching people to actually respect people of color and women, treat women as equals, and all these horrible things that are socialist. But seriously, the schools have always been doing a socialization function of making people, children, at least teaching civics and participating in the process. But at the same time, schools have always perpetuated these stereotypes of America as really being all men and women are created equal and slavery ended in 1865 and all of that, and not really making people aware of all of the unpleasant facts of American history and world history and everything. And to what extent is that both an issue in making it difficult for us advocates of public education to fight for public education, but also to what extent is that something that we need to really legitimately worry about, indoctrinating people?
I think what you're pointing out there is Donald Trump's occasional savvy at distracting people with culture war and with lies. Right. So that is not what our public schools do. They do not indoctrinate young people. And Donald Trump doesn't have the foggiest idea what happens inside America's 98,000 public schools, not the faintest. And what he was doing there was distracting people from the fact that his Secretary of Education was pursuing a policy agenda that is wildly unpopular with the American people, red and blue, if they get whiff of it. And many people were distracted by this so-called 1776 commission and never looked at the fact that Trump's Secretary of Education, like so many far-right conservatives across the U.S. at the state level, have been pursuing policies that the American people don't want anything to do with. And the long history here of the past 35 years has been blaming the schools and convincing the American people that the schools are failing in order to enact an agenda that the people wouldn't necessarily favor were they told a truer story, that the schools are not so bad, that mostly our kids are doing okay, and what we need is incremental change led by parents, families, community members, and educators who know their schools and know how they want to change those schools.
So I'm going to end on a positive note. We are again interviewing Jack Schneider and Jennifer Berkshire. The title of their book, A Wolf at the Schoolhouse Door, The Dismantling of Public Education and the Future of Schools. And that is, here's an upside about the pandemic. We suddenly realize how important schools are, how difficult it is to teach, what they provide for the community, even beyond education. They suddenly have become, if it's kind of like the pandemic is the economy and schools are us. You know, it's just amazing that we've sort of had this sort of come to Jesus moment about education in a way that we could never have explained. But the pandemic has done an amazing job of at least opening some eyes. So here's my prayer, Jennifer and Jack. And that is with the new administration, we take this opportunity that has been presented by the pandemic to be able to really reinforce public education so that it's more vibrant and serves us as a community, our kids for their future, and frankly, for the economy, which needs us to sort of be engaged and knowledgeable and aware. So I think the pandemic may have a silver lining. Let's just hope that they figure it out with this new administration. Thank you so much for joining us. What's the name of your podcast? Your 100 already put in the can. What's it called?
Called Have You Heard? It's excellent. Your listeners should really check it out.
We will make sure that they check it out. Have You Heard? And of course, you should check out The Attitude with Arnie Artisan. All right, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate
it. Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Now, this is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Artisan and producer Ken Barnes. We'll schmooze tomorrow. Ciao.
You, who are on the road, must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well, their father's hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know by. Don't you ever ask them why, if they told you you would cry, so just look at them and sigh.